A few housekeeping things first. Pam has reminded me, if you have had the prayer for becoming a catechumen read over you, that means that you are officially a catechumen, which means you have the fun job of doing paperwork. And if you haven't submitted paperwork to her, you need to. In addition to that, it's really important, especially because it's coming up fast. I mean, we're almost in February now, okay? And we're talking about Holy Saturday baptisms. It's really important that you are also individually meeting with one of the priests. For most people, that's been me. Father Justin's been dealing a lot with the new church, so I've been basically handling catechumen issues for the most part. Not in every case, but in most cases. So most of you I can look at and say, we've met individually once, twice, maybe even three or four times. But some of you I haven't yet. So if we haven't yet, make sure that if not today, tomorrow, grab me after church. Let's set up something. If you don't have my phone number, get one of my cards upstairs. You can just text me or send me an email and just ask when we can meet and we'll set something up. It's gotten to the point where we have so many catechumens. It's kind of rough. We're going to talk about this in a minute. But how many catechumens do you think we have on the books right now? It's about 27 or so. How many times have you seen 27 people at liturgy for the catechumen prayer? We haven't. We haven't. So we got to talk a little bit about that. But that also means that it's getting tough for me to chase after people. And also, you know, we don't want that. We want you chasing after the church, not the church chasing after you. So there's a certain point to which I'm going to chase after you a couple times, and then I'm going to take a step back. And I'm going to say, okay, what do you got? Essentially, we want to see you really have that yearning for the church. Because that's a yearning you have to actually cultivate now. It's not a yearning that exists within the catechumen and then you get baptized and suddenly it's gone and now you're good to go. That's a yearning you're actually trying to create, which means it doesn't happen just naturally. You have to force it a little bit. You have to practice it. You have to practice having a burning heart for God. And so that's your job. That's the job of the catechumen. We give you a list of books. We give you certain things to do. We're not just checking boxes off. We're going to talk about that a lot tonight. That's not the point. The point is, these are the things that will help you cultivate that burning heart for God, but we need to see that. If you want to be baptized, you have to have that burning heart for God. We want to see you want the church. That means Sundays, you want the liturgy. You can't wait to spend time with Christ in the liturgy. It means Saturday evenings for Vespers. You can't wait to prepare for liturgy by coming to Saturday evening Vespers. It means you're badgering the priest. We really want to talk with you because we need to talk about our prayer life. We need to talk about this. We need to talk about that. We want to see that as much as possible. And again, I'm not saying this because it's some like, it shouldn't be manufactured in the sense that it feels artificial. But creating that organic relationship with Christ takes effort on God's part and on ours. The two have to meet. Okay, so God is constantly yearning for you. But at the same time, in striving for you, he also respects your free will. So sometimes that striving looks like God has abandoned me. It's not that God has abandoned you. He's letting your life fall apart so you can finally say, okay, I really need God. I really, really need him. And that's why things are falling apart, is because I haven't really run after him. So if you can't make it to a catechumen class, if you can't make it to a Sunday liturgy, Father Justin or I or both should be receiving a text or an email explaining why. And it's not because we want to control you. That's not it at all. We're trying to make sure you're ready for baptism. And if we know that you have a legitimate reason, like, you know, I threw up all night. Okay, please don't come to church. We don't need that. You know, we don't need you throwing up everywhere. We get it. You want to be here. You want to be here enough where you wanted to inform us, despite the fact that you're throwing up, that you're home. We get that. That's what this is really about. We just want to check and see where you are. But if we see you every other week, or like one out of 3 weeks, and there's like no explanation why, and we're not really meeting with you, and it just starts to get a little bit confused, and we're not really sure what's going on. And again, with 27 or 28 on the books, it's hard for me to go after everybody. You know, it's hard for me to chase after everybody. It's not because we don't love you, you know, but part of our love is that at first we're going to be like in your face, and then we're going to be like, okay, take a step back, let's see where you are. You know, what can you hold on your own? And that's just part of growing up, right? Like, you know, I don't spoon feed my children anymore. Well, Juliana, we do, but the other two, I definitely don't. And when I do, it's a joke, you know, it's a joke for them. This is kind of how we do things. So I'm not trying to harp on you or anything like that. It's just, I want to remind you what this process is about. And we're going to talk a lot about that tonight. This is kind of what the focus is tonight. Two other quick things. Father Justin wanted me to print these out. Father Thomas Hopko is a priest who died, I want to say 3 years ago maybe. Very well-known theologian. He wrote this really phenomenal list, and it's called 55 Maxims of the Christian Life. And they're just little short sayings. The first one is, be always with Christ and trust God in everything. Number two, pray as you can, not as you think you must. I mean, just simple, down-to-earth spiritual guidance with 55 maxims. Now, this is actually 56 and a half, because Father Justin and I added just a couple small little notes. But there's enough here for everyone, so please be sure to take one today. And also, I've had two or three people ask me about this book, Wisdom from the Early Church for Today. I think, I always forget the name, Wisdom for Today from the Early Church, whatever, the David Ford book, the first on the list. St. Vladimir Seminary Press, last I checked, which was this morning, Michelle can back me up on this, they do have copies for sale right now. So I know it's hard to find, but you can find it there. So svspress.com, you can find that book there. It's a little bit expensive. What's that? Yeah, that's the other thing I was going to mention, is it is on Kindle, and it's a lot cheaper on Kindle. It's half the price that you pay for the hard copy. It's a great little primer of church history. I think it's the best introduction to what the Orthodox Church is that you can find. It wasn't intended to be that, but just going through the first four centuries or so of church history, it's a really great introduction to what the church is. So if you like history, it's great. If you don't like history, it's still great, but it's just going to be tougher to get through. But it's not a tough book to read. There's one other book, the one by Elder Cleopa of Romania, The Truth of Our Faith. That one can be bought through Uncut Mountain Supply, but they're out of copies right now. And when they get it in, they tend to blow through them really fast. So if you can't find it, don't worry about it. Okay, I have one copy myself. I'll lend it out to anybody who wants it. But, you know, this is not checking off the boxes. If you're trying to get through the list of books, awesome. And I told Michelle this today, she had some other books that she was reading. And I was like, these can count. You know, it's okay. These are really, really good books. We just want to make sure your the list we came up with is a really good, comprehensive kind of approach to Christianity. If you want to learn how to live the Orthodox life, you read those 13 books, you're good. Again, you don't have to have read all of them. If you've read 5 or 6 or 7 by the time you're baptized, that's great. Just be in the process. But you can supplant it with other ones. There's nothing wrong with that. There's some really great ones. In fact, I highly recommend, and part of what we're going to talk about today is explained so well in this book. There's a book called Eternity is a Moment in Time, or something like that, about this Romanian elder named Elder Arseni Papachoc. We have, I think, 7 or 8 copies in the bookstore right now. It is phenomenal. Father Justin started reading after I told him how great it was. And he had the same reaction I did. He was like, well, I'm on page 50 or so. And I said, yeah, and it's really boring, right? And he goes, yes.
I just finished it.
What did we think?
Outstanding.
Awesome, right? First 50 pages? So, yeah, yawners. It's tough to get through that first 50 pages. I don't care what a great athlete he was when he was young. I don't care. It's not what I read the book. But after you get past that point, it is incredible. One of the best books I've read in years. And you all know I read a lot. So, I mean, if you're reading that one instead of reading, like, Tito Colander's book, fine. That's fine. You know, just let us know what's happening. So keep in contact with us. I think that's all the housekeeping that we had. Pam, do we have any more housekeeping that you know of? Oh, thank you. Okay. Nothing yet. Okay. Before we get to the chapter today, and the chapter is on the teachings of Christ. It's a nice, concise, I mean, what, that should take 10 minutes, right? Joke, promise. There's a special study in here that Father Justin didn't get to last time, and he asked if I would just cover it really quickly, and that's on intercessory prayer. I know I've talked about intercessory prayer with a lot of you already, but it's important that we cover it nonetheless. Typically, when we talk about asking the saints for their intercessions for us, what's the verse that you often hear as an objection to this? There's one mediator between God and man, and that's Christ. Okay, you hear that quite a bit. People bring up that verse a lot. The problem is does anybody know what precedes that verse?
To make intercession for everybody.
Yeah, St. Paul is saying, make sure you pray for your rulers. So when St. Paul brings up that there is one mediator between God and man. Is he talking about mediator in the sense of intercessory prayer? Of course not. Of course not. I don't know a single person who rejects the prayers to the saints or asking of intercessions of saints who also objects to asking one another for prayers. You know, nobody goes like, Bryce, please, I'm going through some tough times. Please pray for me. Well, you can't do that. There's only one mediator between God and man, and that's Jesus Christ. How dare you make Bryce a mediator for you? No one says that. Of course not, because in the scriptures, there's a whole bunch of talk about praying for one another. It's talk about it all the time. So the question really becomes, do we have a living faith or not? Christ says that God is not the God of the dead. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The living ones. They're still living. How do we know this? Because this is what our whole entire faith is about. And we have proof of this, especially in the Transfiguration, right? The Transfiguration, who's talking with Christ? Elijah and Moses. Now, Elijah, there's questions about whether he really died or not. But Moses, there's no question. And yet, there he is talking with Christ. Because what does St. Paul say about death? He says, for me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. It's gain. It's not loss. It's gain. So when we die, we actually grow closer to Christ. So let's go through some verses here. And I didn't write them down. Forgive me. I wish I would have. So if you just write these down, the actual verse, the chapter and verse, these are a good little set of things to give people who object. You know, they see you saying like, oh, St. Anthony, please pray for me. Oh, you can't do that. Why can we do that? Okay, here's a few verses to remember. The first one is what I just said. For me to live is Christ and to die is gain. For us, death has been destroyed. The soul does not go into some cosmic sleep until Christ comes again when we die. Rather, it ascends and the righteous stand with Christ. And what are they doing? Look to the Transfiguration. At the Transfiguration, we see two of the prophets conversing with Christ. This is what we do in life after life, or life after death. We live true life. We've gained. We grow closer to Christ, and we're able to converse with Him. So the next question becomes, well, are the saints aware of what's happening with us? When we make a request of them, do they even know what's happening with us? Another story to remember, the rich man and Lazarus. What happened with the rich man and Lazarus? Who wants to tell it? Okay, I will. I'll tell it. So there's a rich man, and there's Lazarus. Is Lazarus wealthy? No. He's poor, homeless. He stands outside of the gate of the rich man, and the rich man won't even give him what? He won't even give him the crumbs that fall from his table. And they both die. And when they die, where does the rich man go? Hades. Where does Lazarus go? Paradise. The bosom of Abraham, which is an image of paradise. And the rich man has a couple concerns. What's his first concern? He's suffering quite a bit, and so he's thirsty. So he asks that Lazarus dip his finger into water and touch his tongue, and he's told, nope, can't happen. But then he brings up a second concern. What's the second concern? Can I at least go back? Or can Lazarus, can somebody go back and tell my family what's happening so the same thing doesn't happen to them? And Christ tells him what? Or, well, in this case, it's not Christ, but if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they won't even listen to one who has risen from the dead, which is a prophecy of what? Christ's rising from the dead. So if we're not going to listen to Christ rising from the dead, nobody coming back from the dead is really going to help us. So the fascinating thing here is that the rich man who is suffering in Hades is aware of and concerned for his family members. Are you going to tell me that somebody suffering in Hades is aware of and concerned for his family members, but somebody in paradise is not? Of course they are. Of course they are. So put this all together. To die is gain. The righteous in soul converse with Christ and they're aware of our requests. Are they not going to pray for us? Of course they will. And you can find countless. I mean, you could spend your whole life looking at stories of how the saints have interceded for people on this earth. And you'll never even cover them in your own lifetime. they just keep going and going and going. Saints appearing to people. Saints infusing themselves in history in incredible ways. I'll tell you a really quick story about this. My wife's uncle, he's currently on disability because of back problems, but he's a priest. And one day when he was a priest down in Texas at his parish, one of the parishioners went up to him and said, "Who was the visiting priest here today?" And Father Dan is his name. Father Dan looked at him and said, "What are you talking about, visiting priest?" He goes, "Yeah, I looked up in the altar and you were there in the center. On the right side, there was another priest, a really old man, really elderly, wearing green vestments." And Father Dan goes, "You're mistaken. It was only me. I'm the only priest here today." And he goes, no, this is what he looked like." He goes, I'm sure of it. I watched him. He was there. He was praying, doing his cross, doing bows. And so Father Dan goes, "What was he wearing again?" "Some green vestments." And what did it look like? So he describes it. So he goes to the altar. Somebody had given an icon to bless. And he picks this icon up off the altar. And there is this saint looking elderly with a gray beard and green vestments. And he goes, "Is this the guy?" He goes, "Yeah, that's him. Yeah, that's him." This type of stuff is like completely normal for us. I've heard, I know a story in Post Falls, Idaho, of a woman who, she was visiting Orthodox Church for the first time. She was Protestant, evangelical. And she asked who the priest was. And the woman said, "Oh, that's Father Basil." She goes, no, not Father Basil, the other priest. The other priest. She goes, what other priest are you talking about?" She goes, yeah, the other priest, he was wearing black like this, you know, with big sleeves, and he kind of looked like this. And so the woman, who was the deacon's wife at the time, now she's the priest's wife, but the deacon's wife at the time, she goes, "Let's go in the church and look around a little bit." And so she started taking around the church and looking at the icons on the wall. Did he look like this? No. Did he look like this? No. Did he look like this? Finally, she got to an icon of St. Maximus the Confessor. Said, "Did it look like this?" She goes, "Yes. That's him." She had seen this vision of St. Maximus Confessor walk from the hall into the church, and then they went after him, and he was gone. And she sees this icon, and she goes, "That's him." Again, these types of things happen all the time. One of the books in the list, "Our Thoughts Determine Our Lives," by Elder Thaddeus. I have a spiritual child in Cincinnati whose papu, her grandfather, was dying in the hospital. She was very, very close to him, so she was really distraught over this. But on my recommendation, she was reading this book at the time that he was dying. And so she was in his hospital room with him alone. You know, he's now almost in a vegetative state. And she's reading the book, but she's also putting it down every now and then and praying. And she really loved that book. So she was asking the intercessions of Elder Thaddeus. And so out of the corner of her eye, she sees movement in the corner of the room. And she looks over, and there's somebody again, dressed like this in black. And he's doing prostrations, bows, one bow after another, and doing his cross, and clearly praying for her grandfather. And she sees his face. It's the same face in the cover of the book. It was Elder Thaddeus. It's just 4 or 5 years ago. These types of things happen all the time. They happen all the time. The saints absolutely intercede for us. And one last verse to remember from James: "The prayers of a righteous man availeth much." Is all prayer equal?
No.
No. It's not. It's not. It doesn't mean that God doesn't hear us. But there was a monk on Mount Athos once who was granted a vision. He was granted this vision of an overhead view of Mount Athos. And he saw these little sparks flying up in places. In other places he saw flames. And in one place he saw this huge pillar of fire shooting up. And he said, "What is this?" And his angel explained to him, these were the prayers of these holy elders on Mount Athos. And he goes, "Well, why is there a difference?" And it was explained to him that those who are really pure in heart are so close to God that they have this incredible connection, that their prayer shoots up to God like this great pillar. And so he looks at the brightest one and he goes, "Who's that? Whose prayer is that? I want to know whose that is." And he said, "No." He said, "It is not for anyone to know who this is until after he has died. After he has died, it'll be revealed who this is. But for now, he prays in quiet out of humility." It's incredible. So the more pure in heart we are, the more like Christ we are. And the more like Christ we are, the more he recognizes us. You've heard me tell that story that's in that book, Elder Arseny Papachok, where the man knocks on the door of paradise, right? And Christ says, "Who is it?" And he says, "It's me, your faithful servant." He goes, "I don't know who you are. Go away." So he knocks again. And Christ says, "Who is it?" And he says, "It's you." And he says, "Then enter into paradise." That's what Christ is looking for. He wants to look at us and see a mirror in which he sees himself. And the more that our heart reflects Christ, the more our prayer becomes Christ-like. So this is the whole ascetic effort of the church, and this is why we take the saints, who the church has held up as examples of holiness, as examples of those who have run the race and succeeded and done well, the ones who have become holy and have Christ dwelling within them. And we use these examples and we say, as much as I want all of you to pray for me, and I do, and as much as I pray for all of you, my prayer, compared to like St. Zenya over there, or Father Justin Padhu, or St. Justin Popovich, or Saints Peter and Paul, my prayer is pretty worthless. Their prayers you really want. So we ask them to intercede for us. Not only nothing wrong with it, it's really important in the spiritual life. It's essential. Bryce, you had a question.
Well, not so much a question, but like, I was just wondering, like, we went over this one-on-one, but I was wondering if you'd want to, like, address the other evangelical Protestant argument of interceding with the saints, like, this, it, like, some Bible verse that says not to pray, like, with the dead and for the dead.
Yeah, oh, the verse Bryce is talking about in the Old Testament, it says that we aren't to, I can't think of the, what's the word for it when you see these mediums? Spiritualists. What are they? In the Old Testament, it gives a specific term for it. I can't think of what it is right now. But it says we're specifically not supposed to do that, and that way commune with the dead. But what the Old Testament is talking about there is the fact that we can't discern angels from demons. And so don't try to conjure up the dead, for instance, in a seance or something like that, because there's so much room for demonic influence then. There's so much room. So when we ask the saints to intercede for us, do not be hoping. I just told you a bunch of stories of the saints appearing to people. Don't be looking for that. Don't try to obtain that. And if you do see something, the first thing you do, according to the fathers, is reject it. Say, there's no way that I'm worthy to have this vision. Therefore, this must be demonic. And do your cross as a protection. And if it's really demonic, the demons will flee. What will happen then? What if it's a true vision? What if it really is a saint and you just rejected it? Does God get upset about that? No. He honors you for your humility. And so don't seek sounds and sights and lights and things like that. Beware of that type of stuff. We're not conjuring up the saints. We're asking them to intercede for us. There was one elder that I read who said, somebody asked him once, he was like in his late 80s or early 90s, and he'd been a monk for like 70-something years. And somebody said, can you tell us, have you ever had any visions during prayer? And he goes, no, and I thank God for that. And they said, what do you mean you thank God? And he goes, I've prayed that I have no consolation here in this life with visions and sights and sounds and things like that. He said, if I have the consolation here, I won't have it in the next life. And also, I'm weak and I know that I'm easily deceived. So I've prayed to God that I never see anything like that and everything be left for the next life. That's really powerful. That's really powerful.
Just another thing real quick. Like, in Orthodox terminology, even though the saints are like physically dead, I mean, they're in the presence of Christ, right? So like, when you really get down to that, they're not, I mean, truly dead.
Yeah, the question is are the saints truly dead? And the answer, of course, is no. The saying on Mount Athos is, if you die before you die, then you won't die when you die. In other words, if you kill off your own will in asceticism and die before Christ so that Christ dwells inside of you, when you physically die, you're not really dying. As St. Paul says, your death becomes a gain. And so that the saints are the ones who are truly living. Now, are they living in the fullest sense of the word? No, not yet, because they need to be reunited with their bodies, just like we all will be at the second coming. But before that, they're still living more than we are in many ways. In many ways, they are. Yes, Jace.
So, how do... kind of something I've heard before, but how does the early first century church and their collection of relics tie into this topic of intercession for the saints?
That's a bigger topic than I want to get into right now. His question is about how does the early church and their approach to relics tie into this? It does tie into it. It also ties into the fact that we are body and soul. And therefore, when we are filled with grace, it's not just the soul that's filled with grace, the body is as well. And so the early Christians were very jealous about relics. When a Christian would be killed for this faith, they would collect the bodies immediately. And what often happened is miracles started happening because of these, out of these bones and out of these relics. And so the Romans started to realize, we can't let them have the bones because this actually spreads the faith rather than squashes it. And so what they would do is they'd drag the bodies out and throw them to the wild beasts. They'd want the dogs and, you know, whatever was wild in the desert to go and tear these bodies apart and take them. And many of the Christians would hide and they'd wait for these things. And when the Romans left, they'd go and collect the bodies anyway. There's a great story of St. Varus that recounts this. But it's too much to go into now because we have so much to cover and we can't be late for Vespers tonight because it's just me. But if that's not covered by the end of the classes, then bring it up again. All right, a couple more questions, then we got to get to the teaching. Yes?
There's another question, but there's an article, Christ Our Savior people, on their website, they have the speeches, and there's one on that specific topic. You just have to translate it into English.
So. Okay. So Christ the Savior website, there's apparently an article. Google Translate will hopefully translate it well enough. There are also some really good podcasts on this. I think Father Peter Hears had a really good one on this. I could be wrong. I don't remember, but we'll look it up. Okay. Yes. Landon.
So, if we all preach faith with millions of Christians in the world, there's one at the same time, do they have the ability to hear more than one person?
Yeah, so the question is, do the saints have the ability to hear more than one person at a time? I will tell you that even in this life, there are plenty of reports of saints being in two places at once. Literally bilocating, being in two places at one time. And so when you're united with Christ, do space and time constrict Christ? No. And so with the saints, the next life, they also don't constrict them. So yes, millions of people can be praying to them and they can be hearing all the prayers. How does that work? I can't tell you. I'm not there yet. But we know it does work. It does happen. There's a lot of incredible stories about saints being in two places at once or just disappearing one place and appearing in another. I'll tell you one really quick one. There's another Father Arseni from Romania, Father Arseni Boca. And he was imprisoned by the communists in Romania. And one day the guards were doing their checks at night and they were going around making sure all the prisoners were there. And Father Arseni was like, he was like their number one prisoner. Do we know why? He had done something that he was not supposed to do. He told the communist leader of Romania, Ceausescu, how he was going to die. He prophesied to him and told him how he was going to die. He told him there was going to be a quick trial, and then he was going to be shot by the people with his wife. And that's exactly what happened to him years later. Ceausescu didn't like that, so he really didn't like Father Arseni Boca, so he threw him into prison. So they're checking the cells, and they get to Father Arseni Boca's, and he's gone! And they're thinking, we're in deep doo-doo, because you know what the communists would do if you lost a prisoner. You were gone. You were gone. So they were freaking out. So they're looking all around. They're trying to figure out where he is that night. They can't find him. And then suddenly they go back to his cell, and there he is. And they said, where were you? I was here the whole time. A couple months later, there was another communist who was visiting from the other part of the country. And he went to the prison where Father Arseni was, and he asked some of the guards, he's like, I want to ask you something. Why did you let him out a couple months ago? They said, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, you let him out. They said, we've never let him out. He said, yeah, his mother died, and he did the funeral. I witnessed it with my own eyes. He was on the other side of the country. And they said, when did this happen? Well, it happened the night he disappeared. How do you explain that one? You know, these things happen. Okay, last question before we haven't even gotten to the main talk yet.
Helping me kind of unlearn a little bit of learning. When one dies, and we talk about Hades or paradise, in my mind, I'm thinking of two separate places. Is it two separate places, or is Hades just Hades where everybody goes and progresses and stuff?
Yeah, so this is a really, really big topic, and the question is, how do we understand Hades and paradise after we die? Are they the same place with different levels, or how do we really understand this? When you ask the question, and again, I'm not going to go into all the detail about this because it's a really big topic, but when you ask the question, are they different places? You're going to find the answer yes and the answer no, depending on where you read. And the reason is it depends on how we're looking at this. In one sense, Hades and paradise are really the same concept. It's the love of God. The love of God is everywhere, and how we experience that love depends on whether we experience it as paradise or as Hades. So do we experience the love of God as warmth and as joy and as the fulfillment of everything we've ever desired and as love, or do we experience it as burning fire and condemnation? It depends on what the state of our soul is. You know, this is the same thing that the fathers say about the sun. They say the sun, it's the same light and the same heat, but it has very different results whether it's beating down on clay or on wax. It softens the wax, but it hardens the clay. So we have to be cautious about how we approach God, because the grace of God will affect us in different ways. So in one sense, it's the same thing. On the other hand, while we have to be cautious about talking about hell and heaven or paradise and Hades as places, quote unquote, there is a clear separation in the scriptures. Christ is very, very clear about how the sheep and the goats will be separated. And so they are different places in that sense. But what does it really mean to be a place? I mean, all of creation will be transfigured. Space and time will be transfigured. You're never going to look at your watch or look at a calendar and say, "Oh, I've been in heaven for 3,822 years today." No, that type of time is gone. It's the eternal now. But is there a sense of time? Yes, because all things will be transfigured, even time. So how do we really understand this separation? We don't really. But we know that they can't be all together in the same sense that could heaven be pure bliss if you look over and you see your neighbor suffering? No way. There's no way. So the fathers do talk about that there will be a separation in that sense. Okay. All right, last one. All right, thank you. Eli, I appreciate that. Because let's put it off for right now, because we have 40 minutes left and I have about 2 hours worth of material to go through. So we're going to talk about the teachings of Christ, okay? It's actually a pretty short chapter in Carlton's book, but there's a really lot of jumping off points. So I'm going to it's going to be hard to believe. I'm going to talk fast. I know I never do that. I always do that. Father Justin and I are known for talking fast, but I'm going to talk really fast because I want to get through as much of this as possible. So when we look at the church, what exactly are we talking about? There are a lot of images. The main one being the body of Christ. We talk about the ark of salvation. We talk about the hospital for the sickness of sin. But we also have to understand that the church is the continuation of Christ's ministry on this earth. Christ's ministry did not end when he ascended. It's not as if it just was done, period, gone. And it didn't also end when the last book of the Bible was written, when the book of Revelation was written. It's not like Christ's ministry then just ended, and now we just have to look back to that and base everything on that. That's a dead faith. It's a dead faith. Christ promised to send the Holy Spirit who would lead the church into all truth. That is not a one-time deal. It's a continual thing. The Holy Spirit comes to establish, to preserve, and to enliven and enlighten the church constantly. It's a living reality. So Christ's teachings do not end when Christ ascends into heaven. His ministry continues. And we're living in that ministry now. This is Christ's ministry here and now. There's a great elder in Serbia. This is really going to scandalize some of you. But he meant it to be a scandal. He absolutely meant it to be a scandal. He was teaching a class at seminary. And some of his students kept going with a kind of a Protestant mind back to the Bible. Yeah, but what about the scriptures? What about the Bible? What about when the Bible says this, that? So he picked up the Bible and he threw it at the window. And it smacked against the window and he said, "That's the Bible! That's the Bible!" Well, outside of the window was the seminary church. And his point wasn't to be disrespectful of the Bible, but he was doing something really scandalous, and he was a bit of a fool for Christ. He was doing something really scandalous to remind us that we don't base our faith just in the typed words or written words of a book. Again, that can be a dead faith. It can be a dead faith because we sit there and we rely on these words that were written, but the life of those words is no longer organic. It's stuck between covers. Where do we find the true Bible? You find it in the life of the saints, the ones who live out the scriptures. They're the ones who really reveal what the Bible means to us. And so it's in the church, this hospital for the sickness of sin, that we find the true message of Christ continually being given, continually being enlivened, being imputed into our hearts, being lived. It's a powerful image. And we have to remember that the church is not an institution, it's an organism. It has life. It has human life and it has divine life. And the divine life is seeking to sanctify the human life. That's the church. But when we look back at Jesus as a teacher, we come across some interesting things, especially in our world today. There are those who now reject Christ as a teacher. There are some of the what we call the new atheists who are pretty harsh on Christ, and they say that what he taught was just crazy and he was this and that. But for most of human history, even those who are not Christian would look at Christ and say, well, he was still a good teacher. We believe he was a good person. He was a good teacher. But they fail to see what it means to be a good teacher and what Christ really meant in a lot of what he said. And the reason is that in order to really understand Christ, you have to actually live that gospel life. Again, it has to be living and organic. So I heard a Roman Catholic priest once. He asked this series of questions. This is really fascinating. Love this. It's incredible. He said, he was talking to another priest, this was on a radio program, who was saying that, you know, sometimes it's very frustrating because as much as you try to do what's right, some people are just going to reject it no matter what. You can teach the right things and some people are just going to reject it and leave no matter what. And he said, you know, as a priest, that's especially painful when you see people and you know that they really need this because everybody needs it. I need it, first and foremost. And you see people reject it. And so his fellow priest said, he said, when Christ was on earth, every single thing that he did, was it the most perfect thing to do in that situation at that time, such that nobody could ever improve upon it? He said, yes. And he said, everything he taught and said, was it the exact perfect thing to say, such that nobody could ever improve upon it? Yes. And the way he did and said those things, did he do it in a way such that nobody in all of human history could ever improve upon it? Yes. And then he said, and when he was crucified, how many followers of his stuck near him? Small handful. Few women and John. And that's it. You couldn't have a more perfect ministry than Christ. And yet, when he died, it looked like it was a failure. So Christ's teachings really depend on us. They really depend on us. We can look at Christ as a universally good teacher, but we really misunderstand him if that's where we stop. When we live the Christian life, we begin to realize the fullness of this image. But because we often don't live it, we're often given these images of Christ that are false. So what are the two main images on these polar opposite extremes that we usually see? On the one hand, we see the wrathful God who can't wait to throw sinners into hell. And on the other hand, we see the gentle Jesus, what I call the hippie Jesus, or in some books I've read, the feminized Jesus. And you know this, you see pictures of Jesus with the rosy cheeks, the long flowing hair, and his beautiful braids shining in the sun, and he would never say anything to hurt your feelings ever. False. On both accounts, false. This is not the way Christ functioned. This is not what he said. This is not what he did. He didn't go to either of these extremes. And we have to remember this too. There's no dichotomy at all between the Old Testament God and the New Testament Christ. It's the same figure. I was emailing somebody recently. They were asking about this. They said they had a lot of friends asking why God was so wrathful in the Old Testament. You don't see this God of mercy that you see in the New Testament. I said, anybody who says that has not read the Old Testament. If you read the entire New Testament, you see a God of mercy. You see a God constantly giving people chances over and over. You see a God who says that he desires mercy and not sacrifice. It's not just from the New Testament. That's quoted from the Old Testament. It's Hosea. You read the Psalms, and you see a very merciful God in many cases. In some cases, was that merciful God acting in ways that seem really harsh to us? Yes. But take the gentle Jesus of the New Testament and actually read the New Testament and see how Christ actually acts. Was he always the gentle Jesus? No. He takes his chief disciple, an apostle, Peter, and calls him Satan. Look what he says. We have to remember, Christ didn't just love the apostles. He loved the Pharisees and the Sadducees too, with a perfect love. And how did that perfect love manifest itself? You brood of vipers! You hypocrites! Constantly. Look at the book of Acts. When people tried to deceive the apostles, dead on the spot. This is a much larger picture. It's a much more complex picture. It's kind of looking at Christ in 3D rather than 2D. It's not this simple image. There's a lot more to God and the way that he works with us, because he's going to use any means necessary for our salvation. And sometimes that looks really harsh, and sometimes it looks really gentle, but most of the time it looks somewhere in between. We have to understand that Old Testament God is the same as Christ in the New Testament. And if we read the whole thing, we begin to understand that. Now, we can get into specific examples and why those happened. We're not going to get into that right now. There's reasons for that as well. The fathers talk a lot about these examples. There's plenty of wisdom to gain from the fathers. But we have to get the whole picture. And in getting the whole picture, this means not only reading the scriptures, but living the life of the church, listening to the hymns, and reading the life of the saints. You see some things. That's why I really can't stand that question, that bumper sticker question, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Because when we ask that, the assumption is that you know what he would do. But if you were reading the scriptures for the first time, in a million years, would you ever guess that Christ was going to make a whip and go into the temple and overturn the tables and whip everybody out? I wouldn't. I certainly wouldn't. People are about to stone a woman for adultery. And Christ gives that incredible line, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." Would you have ever guessed that? I wouldn't have. We don't know what Christ would do in many cases. This is why we need to unite with him. This is why we need to seek him in all things. The reality is that if we have humility, we're going to look at that question and say, I have no idea what Christ would do. All I can do is try to look at the situation with as much love and humility as possible. And by the way, when you're in different situations in life, you have to deal with things in different ways. I had a great conversation with Father Silouan at the monastery a few weeks ago about this. I was reading where Elder Sophroni of Essex says, he says, you know, with the humble, you can be humble. But with those who are really prideful, sometimes you shouldn't be humble, because they use that as an opportunity to basically badger you and hammer you even more. I read that and I was really shocked. There's another saying from a different person, this really holy nun, who said the Christian should be like asphalt. You let everybody walk all over you, and all you do is hold them up in return. So I asked Father Silouan, I said, how can you reconcile those two sayings? They both seem right to me. How do you reconcile? And he talked about how, depending on your situation in life, and depending on the particular situation at hand and who you're dealing with, you have to act in different ways. And sometimes it's hard to discern that. But he said, especially as a priest, he said, if your response is to accept everything with humble silence, that can actually be really damaging to people. You could actually be encouraging them in their sin. That was really hard for me to hear at first, because that was my last parish. It's people who are constantly pummeling me. And I thought at the time that just humbly and quietly, silently accepting it, maybe they would see that I was trying to bear this, and they would take that as love and transform. What I should have done is looked at them and said, you're being a prideful jerk right now. That would have been really loving, because I would have tried to lead them into salvation that way, if they were ready to hear it, which in many cases people aren't. But depending on the situation, and as a priest especially, I have to be cautious about these types of things. So we take the sayings of Christ, the sayings of the fathers, in our personal situations. We have to be careful about these teachings. There's no one-size-fits-all teaching. And that's why we talked about, you know, recently you were talking with Father Jefferson about confession. And one of the things, remember I was walking by and I said, you know, please mention that whatever you talk about with your spiritual father, you don't go and announce to other people. Why? Well, because if you're dealing with a sin, and you're dealing with a sin, and you're dealing with a sin, and it's the same sin, but I give you completely different medicine, you're all going to go, well, you gave me 50 prostrations, and you gave that person two. How is that fair? Different people require different medicine. They require different medicine. There's no one-size-fits-all. This is a living relationship with Christ. The reality is that we really want rules. We like that. We like to just have rules. There's a priest I know in Boston. And I was driving with him one day. We stopped to get some gas. And the guy working there was Muslim. So he asked him, he goes, oh, are you Muslim? He saw the cassock. And the priest looked at me. He goes, no, I'm Orthodox Christian. Do you know what that is? And he goes, no. And he just kind of walked away. And this priest, he said, yeah. He goes, typically with Muslims, they really don't want to know. And I said, tell me, why do you think Islam is on on the rise here in this country so much. I mean, I don't know if it still is, but for many years it was the fastest growing religion in America. I don't know if you know that. After 9/11, Islam was the fastest growing faith after 9/11 in America. And he said, I think it's actually really simple. He says, Islam teaches you that if you do this, 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 and this, try to go to Mecca once in your life, pray 3 times a day, you know, there's certain rules. And if you do all those things and fulfill those requirements, you're good to go. And you find salvation. And he said, we've grown up in a country where most parents have stopped giving their children boundaries. And when they find a faith that gives very clear boundaries and says, if you just follow these rules, you're good to go, it's very comforting. It makes people feel safe. So that reminded me of when I was in high school. I had one of my first jobs was working at a daycare. And there was a woman. She was like, she was the sassy black woman. She was like, oh no, you didn't just do that. Get over here, you know? Like, she was hilarious, but she was really tough with the kids. But the kids gravitated towards her. She was tougher than any other person who worked there. And they loved her. And they wanted so badly to please her and to make her happy. So I asked her one day, you know, I'm just this high school kid, and here she is, much older than me. She had grandkids, and she was working this job, and I said, what? I said, boy, the kids really love you, but you're so tough. And she said, that's because that's what they want. She said, most of them at home have nothing. They have no boundaries. They don't know what's safe. With me, they know exactly what they can and can't do. And she said, it makes them feel safe. So I think this is the way that we'd really like to approach Christ and orthodoxy in the scriptures. We'd love to find just a set of rules. When we talk about the teachings of Christ, some people will say, they said the teachings of Christ, what do you mean? When you say Christ's commandments, like in the Old Testament, it's pretty clear. There's 10 commandments. There are a lot of other rules besides that. I don't know if you know that, but read the whole thing. You find out 10 commandments wasn't the be-all and end-all, but those were like set apart. These 10 commandments, these are really important. So when you say Christ's commandments, what do you mean? I mean everything that Christ said, everything he did, and everything he continues to reveal in the church through the lives of the saints. Everything. There's no set of rules. If you notice in the scriptures, how systematic are the scriptures? Take any topic. Let's say acquisitiveness, love of the things of this world. Where should you go to learn about that in all its fullness in scriptures? What's the one chapter you want to look to?
There is no one chapter.
Thank you. Trick question. There is no one chapter.
There's scriptures.
Exactly. Read the Bible. Read the whole thing. And then read the canons, and then read the fathers, and read the lives of the saints, and read the hymns of the church, and then maybe you'll start to understand it once you start to live it. What? They're not systematic. And so when we try to systematize everything, I think we're making a big mistake. Because what we're trying to do is actually take a living, organic thing and again, make it a dead book that we can sit there and study, and we can study our way into salvation. Look up the Orthodox Christian catechism that every single one of you should have. Oh wait, there isn't one. There isn't one. If you go to the Catholic Church, there is one. I have a couple copies of it. In fact, it was recently updated by Pope Francis, right? When he was talking about the death penalty, he decided to change the catechism. I don't know how you can do that. You know, the catechism that's been solid for 2,000 years, but I'm going to make a change. It's kind of a strange thing. But everything's systematized. My question is, can we improve upon the teachings of Christ? Can we improve upon the scriptures? No. And this is why with all of you, we give you a list of books that we want you to read. But if you haven't read them all, and if you read some other things, big deal. What's the main question? I mean, for the catechumens I have met with, what's the main thing? What's the first thing we talk about? I was just doing a house blessing like right before I came here. And what's the first thing when we sat down? What's the first thing I asked them? How's your prayer life? How's your prayer life? That's what I really want to know. I'm not going to test you on, can you tell me the difference between ousia and hypostasis? Can you tell me the date of the Seventh Ecumenical Council, 787? Can you tell me where it occurred in Nicaea? I don't care if you know that or not. I don't care. What I care about is, are you living the faith? Are you fasting, praying, doing spiritual reading, and coming to church? And when you're baptized, are you coming to confession so that the things that you're dealing... I'm the one who's supposed to know this stuff better, by the way. I should know the ascetic literature enough so that when you bring a certain sin, I can say, okay, this is the proper medicine for it, and this is how it's best applied in your life. That's why you go to a spiritual father. Do I care whether you know how many chapters are in the ladder of divine ascent? Not at all. Not at all. You can try to systematize all of it, and I'll tell you that I made the mistake of doing this when I first started paying attention to my faith. I read everything I could get my hands on. I tried to memorize it all, and you know what it did? it made me worse, not better, because I started to become really prideful. I started walking around thinking that I knew the answers. And I walked in, I became the crazy convert. You may have heard this before. Crazy convert syndrome. What is that? You walk into your church and say, well, this isn't Orthodox. This isn't how that you should be doing it. This is a good monastery because they do it like this. And this is a bad monastery because they do it like this. And this is a good priest and this is a bad priest. And this is a good Orthodox church and this is a bad Orthodox church. Are you kidding me? Come on. I was a prideful jerk. And you know what it took? It took a really holy priest yelling at me in confession, making me beet red and embarrassed, to drive it out of me. He looked at me and he said, you know, it would be really nice if you would judge yourself as much as you judge absolutely everybody else. And I went, and I walked out of there with my stomach hurting, beet red. And this guy was so holy, he like screamed the demon out of me. After that, I was okay with everything I saw around me, and suddenly I could actually start living the spiritual life. All my knowledge wasn't for help. It wasn't for good. It destroyed me. And that's when I realized, you know nothing. You idiot. I could look in the mirror and say, you are a fool. You know nothing. You knew plenty of facts and you didn't apply them. And had you applied them, you would have stopped trying to read so much and tried praying a heck of a lot more. Transform my life. Nothing better than that priest yelling at me. So one of the pinnacles of my spiritual life. I'm still an idiot, but now I can accept that without feeling terrible about it. You know, at the time I just felt like I felt horrible. Now I thank God every day that priest said that to me. It was really good for me. So it's not about learning all the knowledge. And this is why the books that we gave you notice most of them are not just informational. They're mostly about the spiritual life. We want to teach you how to start living the spiritual life. And this is what the teachings of Christ are really about. Okay? So as I said, it's foolish to try to improve upon God. There's no standard Orthodox catechism. There are great little catechisms, but they're all pretty simple. The reality is that theology is a living reality. It's about a living relationship with Christ. And you can't touch on anything. Theology is a circle. If you touch on any one topic, you have to touch on every other topic. That's why it's not systematic. If you talk about what we call Mariology, which there is no category of Mariology in the Orthodox Church, but let's take it, theology about Mary, well, then you have to talk about the Incarnation, which means you have to talk about Christ, which means you have to talk about the prophets, which means you have to talk about the fall, which means you have to talk about creation, which means you have to talk about the nature of God. You have to talk about everything. You can't systematize it. So how do you begin to learn it? Well, yes, read. Reading is good. Trying to understand these things intellectually, it's a good benefit, but it's not the main focus. And sometimes it's the simplest of the saints who really had very little of that technical understanding who became the holiest. You know, you've heard me say this before. St. Athanasius, one of the most brilliant men in the empire at the time, fighting against Arius, would go get advice from St. Anthony, who was out in the desert and who we have evidence didn't know how to read. He recognized that his spiritual life was higher. So there's no simple set of rules or instructions. And it's not to say that we live the faith without those things. There are rules and instructions. But the point is that this is about a life. Jesus' teachings destroy the concept of rule following to be right with God. That's what the Old Testament looked like to the Jews. If we just follow these rules, we don't do the don'ts, and we do the do's, then we're going to be right with God. And Christ came along and he destroyed that. He absolutely destroyed that. He said, no one is good but God alone. In other words, you could follow all the rules and still not be good. If you want to be good, you need to live a life of continual, deepening, lifelong repentance. You need to embrace the cross, because through suffering, you're going to learn humility. And in humility, you're going to lessen yourself. You're going to decrease yourself. You're not going to be good. You need to get yourself out of the way. You're the reason that things aren't going well. So get yourself out of the way and make room for Christ in your heart. Christ is good. So you're not going to be good on your own. You're going to have He who is good dwell within you. In other words, it's not about moral justification. It's about transformation. That's the whole entire Christian life. It's about being transfigured and transformed by having Christ dwell within us. And for Christ to dwell within us, we have to get the person who's already dwelling within us out of the way. And that's us. We love ourselves too much. We love our own comfort too much. And so we get those things out of the way, and then we come to church, and we're infused with grace. We're infused with Christ. We eat Christ and have him dwell within us. Okay, I'll take one quick... Is it quick?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I hope so.
All right.
Do you think...
Nothing's quick in Orthodoxy, but we'll try it anyway.
Do you believe that it was your knowledge that destroyed your humility, or your pride that destroyed your knowledge and made it?
Knowledge can lead to pride if we're not living the faith. If you're living it, if your focus is prayer and fasting, listen, if you're choosing at night to read about the faith rather than to go live it through prayer, then you know you're on a dangerous path. But if prayer becomes the priority and the services become the priority, and shutting off that voice in your head becomes the priority, and not looking at other people and what they are or aren't doing becomes the priority, then when you go read, it's not going to become harmful to you.
Am I right in thinking that we do want to avoid both a understanding that is pride, as well as a humility that is only ignorance?
Yeah, we're not equating humility and ignorance at all. I'm not saying that's why I'm saying. I mean, we wouldn't give you those books to read. You wouldn't have this catechism if ignorance were what we were striving for. That's not the point. But the point is that we have to be very cautious about where we are in the faith. And this is why a spiritual father is helpful. For some people, reading and learning makes them more humble. They sit there and say, my goodness, the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. And really, that's where we all want to get to. But for some people, reading too much is actually a danger. So I'll give you an example of this. I had a parishioner once who... He was challenging a lot of the things in the faith the more he read. And he was reading all this really deep theology that he didn't understand one bit of. He thought he did, but he didn't understand it. And it was causing him to move further and further from the faith. And this was destroying his family because now he decided, well, I'm not going to go to the Orthodox Church. I found some little sect somewhere that really understands the stuff, and I'm going to drive 2 hours to church, and my family can keep coming here, which is only 10 minutes away. And the wife was just, like, distraught. And so he met with me. And he starts challenging, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And finally, I looked at him and I said, you know what? And this is one of those times where I actually was not just humble and silent. I said, shut up. I very lovingly said, shut up. And stop reading this. You don't understand one bit of this stuff. You're thinking that these saints who lived for 30 years in asceticism before they began even engaging with this stuff, and they only engaged it because they had to. And he stopped me to say, well, shouldn't we be able to give an answer to people? Shouldn't we be able to know this stuff? I said, when the time is right, and clearly the time isn't right for you because this is turning you into a jerk. This is turning you into an absolute jerk. So I said, stop reading theology. Go read the lives of the saints instead and go pray. And he left in a huff, but he agreed to try it for a month. 2 weeks later, he came to me and just like downcast face, completely humbled, in tears. He goes, Father, I get it. Thank you. And his wife came to me and thanked me too. She was like, life is so much better at home. He goes, I get it. He goes, I don't know a thing. I don't know a thing. And he goes, this is really teaching me. So for him, knowledge was really dangerous. Now, after he humbled himself, after a while, you could start delving into that stuff little by little. But it was no longer out of intellectual curiosity. It was just out of love of God. That was a very different motivation.
So we should wait until we have to engage with these things because they're becoming...
Here's a great rule of thumb for you.
Yeah.
Ask your spiritual father about reading things before you read them.
Okay.
It's simple. You know, if you come to me and say, Father, this year I really want to read The Rudder, which is the whole entire set of canons of the church and all the commentary. It's like 1,000 pages. I'm going to say, ha-ha, no.
You probably shouldn't have told me that existed.
Yeah. Don't worry, you can't find copies of it. And if you do, they're like hundreds and hundreds of dollars. I scanned the whole thing. Sell mine on Amazon, but if you're gonna willing to pay $400 for it, then go ahead and try to read it. Cole, really quick, yeah.
Yep, really quick commentary. There's a great example of kind of what you're talking about within the confines of the books you had us read for catechism. Father Arseny was a absurdly overeducated man, had written, you know, papers on every conceivable thing, had a master's degree in art, and there were people who thought he was a simpleton when they met him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is we're all called to be fools for Christ's sake. You know, so we don't hold ourselves above people with that. Now that we have saints who are brilliant and who are called to give lectures all over the world, Saint Nikolai Velimirovich was one of them. You know, but he also lived in great suffering. You know, people thought at the end of his life, this may scandalize some of you, he would smoke sometimes, and he would drink too much sometimes. People were really shocked by this. I mean, this was supposed to be a really holy bishop, and you're doing a couple things you're not supposed to do. Then he died. And you know what they discovered? They began preparing his body for burial, and they discovered lacerations and wounds and scars all over his body from when he was imprisoned in Serbia. They had beaten him mercilessly. And the pain of that stayed with him, and so every now and then he'd have a little smoke, not very often, but he would, or he might drink too much. They realized, my goodness, this guy suffered more than any of us had ever realized. And he lived a life of great suffering. Even living his last years in America were pure suffering for him. He really wanted to be back in his homeland of Serbia, but they wouldn't let him back. It was pure suffering for him. So they began to realize, okay, we judged this guy wrong. We judged him wrong. So was he a brilliant guy who would give lectures all over the place? Yeah, but every second of his life after that imprisonment, during that imprisonment and after, was pure suffering. He really lived it. Okay, we're halfway through and we have 7 minutes. So let's try to get through this. Okay, so it's not about moral justification. It's not about doing everything right. It's about transformation. By the way, this means, and oh, I want to get into this so much, it's like a 15-minute lecture, so I'm not going to do it. But I'll tell you right now, this means that even your falls can be part of your transfiguration. Even your falls can be for holiness. Why? Because they lead you to humility. When you fall, don't sit there and say, I can't believe this. This is terrible. I knew I should have done this. Stop having high expectations for yourself. When you fall, look at yourself and say, of course I did, idiot. Of course I fell. Then look at Christ and continue the struggle. If every time you fall, you're inspired to pray more and to rely on Christ more, it's increasing your humility, and eventually the demons are going to go, every time we make him fall, it leads him to greater humility and greater prayer. This isn't working too well. That's what we want. We want to frustrate them by constantly going back to Christ. Of course you're going to fall. St. Siloam the Athenite. I know some of you know this because I say it to you all the time. What is the Christian life according to St. Siloam the Athenite?
Keep your mind in hell and your body despair not.
Keep your mind in hell and despair not. There's one other saint I'm thinking of. How do you define the Christian life? What does it look like to be a Christian? You fall and get back up again. He did not say the Christian life is about never falling. Of course, you should struggle not to fall. That's not the point. But the point is that the Christian is defined by his repentance, first and foremost. That's what will define Christianity. That's what defines Christians. It's when we fall, we immediately put our... It's because we took our eyes off of Christ, you put your eyes back on Christ, and you get back up again. And you do it again and again and again and again. And it doesn't become a surprise anymore. You expect that you're going to fall because we're all idiots, spiritually speaking. We're all morons. And that's okay. Because my strength is made perfect in weakness. If Christ is going to be strong in us, we need to embrace our weakness. It's really important to do. Okay, so getting back to God in the Old Testament. Some people look at God in the Old Testament, they say, well, those people were held to such a high standard compared to us. If they break a rule, they're stoned. You know, some of the Jews wanted to strike. They said, it's not fair that the Levites are the priesthood class. We want the priesthood. And so what happened to them? The earth opened up. God swallowed them into the earth. And we look at that and we say, well, they were held at such high standards. Thank God we have this Jesus who is so nice to us and is never mean to us. And this is just so much easier. So much easier. Is that how we treat our own kids? When they're young and we give them spankings, is that because we're holding them to a higher standard than when they're teenagers or adults and we stop spanking them? No. It's because they're infant. They're young. And when we're young spiritually, God deals with us in much more direct and black and white ways. But now we've been given this knowledge. We've been given the pearl of great price. Everything's been explained. And so we're held to a higher standard. And we have to be responsible for this. The teachings of Christ are our responsibility. And that doesn't mean you look at them and you sit there and every time you find a new commandment of Christ, you find a new thing we're supposed to do, and you go, oh, this is just another thing. Because then you're doing the spiritual life wrong. It's not a burden. When you find a new way to please Christ, your heart should rejoice. Oh, a new way to please my Savior. That's a loving heart. That's an Orthodox Christian heart. That's the heart that's burning and on fire for Christ. That's the heart that looks at prayer, your night prayers, and doesn't say, oh, just another thing I have to do, and I have so much to do. Look at my schedule, I have 10 billion things to do, and now I just have to add prayer to it. No, it says, prayer is a refuge from all of this stuff. All this other stuff is a distraction from Christ, and at night I get to spend 10 or 15 or 20 minutes and just be with Christ, and I can't wait for it. You will long for prayer if you start looking at it that way. Does it happen right away? No. But you have to push for it. And the more you practice that, the more you're going to long to be with Christ. This is how people can go to the liturgy for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 50 years, 60 years, at least once a week, and never grow bored of it. They grow to love it more and more and more. Because as they grow, that heart is being purified more and more, and suddenly the liturgy opens itself up more and more and more. They yearn to be with Christ. How can we yearn to be with Christ in heaven for all eternity if we don't even want to be with him for 10 minutes at night? We got to think about those things. And how do we learn to love being with him? Be with him. Be with him. We also have to realize with this that, and this is a little aside here, but if we're given this responsibility of the revelation of God to us, and now we're responsible for it and we have to live it, it also means that we have to protect it and guard it closely. When people ask you about the Orthodox faith, you don't need to go into deep theology. You don't need to tell them about hesychism and the prayer of the heart. We guard these secrets. These we keep close to us because we are responsible for the knowledge that we have. And we want that knowledge because we love Christ. But also we recognize that we have something really precious and really special here that we want to hold close. This is why catechumens used to leave the liturgy after the prayers for the catechumen. The faith was guarded closely. When it's not, when it's open, I'm not saying it's bad that it's open like it is today, but sometimes we take this for granted. Can you imagine if this was like karate and like you get certain belts? Like, you know, I'm an Orthodox Christian. Well, what belt are you? Red belt. I've been through the white belt and the yellow belt. And I got the red belt. And so, you know, I'm doing really good. I got to go through blue and purple and then black or whatever the order is. Can't wait till I'm a black belt. Because when I'm a black belt, and that takes a good 20 years, then they're going to give me a Bible. And only people who are black belts get to read the Bible. If that's how it was, when you got your Bible, you would hold it so close and you would read it every day and you wouldn't let a single day pass where you didn't read it. And you would seek to the fathers to understand it better. You would love it. So there's a virtue in holding these things really close to us because then when you obtain it, you love it more. That's why, by the way, as catechumens, we want you really striving for it so that you know what you have when you get it. But it means we have to be cautious when we speak to people about what the church teaches. Just be simple. Orthodox Christian, what is that? We believe that Christ died and resurrected for us and that we want his life inside of us. And so he left us his church, which gives us the medicines to be able to do that. That's what the church is about. I mean, keep it simple. Keep it simple. Anyway, end of that aside. Okay, we're getting through this. let's talk about this higher calling that we're called to really quickly. Carlton uses the kind of standard example that we give. Okay. This is a reminder that Christ did not do away with the Old Testament. And he's not calling us to something lesser. He's calling us to something much higher. So how is the responsibility higher? Ye have heard it. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. And whoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto thee, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, or fool, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. And in another section, just after that, ye have heard that it is said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto thee that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath already committed adultery with her in his heart. This is a higher calling. This is what we're doing. We're seeking perfection. Be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. That is not poetic license. That's not just some frou-frou saying that we set aside. Again, everything that Christ taught was the perfect thing to say. So the perfect saying is be perfect. How can we be perfect if I can't even be good? You're right. So get rid of yourself, empty your heart of your own self-love and love of this world, and start to love God so much that he makes his dwelling here. And he who is perfect will dwell inside of you and transfigure you and make you perfect himself. That's what we're doing. So if that's what we're doing, the next question is how do we do it? How do we become perfect? Again, it's not by just doing the right thing. Like I said, it's about making he who is perfect dwell within us. So this is the gospel. What is the teaching of Christ? The teaching of Christ is embrace the cross. Embrace the cross so that he who is perfect can come and dwell inside of you. Be crucified with Christ so that he can resurrect within you. That's everything. Christ gave himself for us, so we give ourselves for Christ. So by the commandments of Christ, we mean all that Christ teaches us, whether from his own mouth, through the apostles, through the church. And all this is not, and this, I really want to leave you with this, we got to wrap it up. This is not about being authoritarian. The church is not about being authoritarian in telling you how you should live and how you shouldn't live. That's not the point. The point isn't to set down a bunch of rules and tell you, these are the do's, these are the don'ts, and just go live it, because God said so. The whole point is that God gives us these instructions on how we live so that we might truly live. He came to give life and give life in abundance, give it more abundantly. He wants us to really live. This is about love. This is not about control. It's about love. But if we're going to live how we truly should live, how we really want to live, if we want to really be fulfilled in our hearts, then these commandments are given as medicine for us. This is why we do what Christ asks of us. So when we wrap all this up, we have to understand that these concepts, there are three concepts that are absolutely united into one. You cannot have one without the other. We need to have love. The true yearning of every human heart is to love and to be loved. That's what we really want. We want love. You cannot find a person who is enraptured with love who's miserable, who wants to go shoot up a school, who thinks about suicide, who hates his brother. Love wipes away all of this. We need love. But I cannot fit you in my heart if I'm already filled with myself. So I need to get rid of myself, which means love absolutely necessitates humility. We need humility. We cannot live as Christians without striving for humility. We have to get rid of our self-love of constantly looking after what I want, what I want to do, what I feel like doing, what's comfortable for me. Love and humility absolutely go together. But we also can't get humility without suffering. That's why I want you to read that book by Father Arseny Papichal. You want to read about somebody who really suffered and who understands suffering? Read that book. He'll explain to you why suffering and humility go together. But the reality is it's pretty simple. I can't get rid of myself unless I'm forced to. I can try. But as long as I'm trying to do it in a comfortable way, guess what? I'm really seeking to get rid of myself in a way that's comfortable for me, which means I'm not really seeking to get rid of myself. It doesn't work. It's got to hurt a little bit. And it's not because we're masochists. It's not because we want you to be in pain. It's because when we're crucified with Christ, then we resurrect with him. It's because this is just the nature of humanity. We are inclined towards sin, which means we love the things which take us away from God. That's what sin is. It's not doing something bad. It's about turning our gaze and focus off of Christ and onto something else. That's what sin is. And we love sin. That's why we sin so much, because sin is comfortable. The devil does not hand you a bottle of poison that says poison on it and says, here, drink. He laces really good chocolate chip cookies with poison. And he says, here, eat these. They're tasty. They smell great. You're going to love them. And we love them. And every bite we savor. And then as we're done, and we've swallowed those cookies, our stomach starts to hurt. And we go, that was a mistake. Do you know how many texts I get every single week of, Father, I can't bear it anymore. I'm in such despair. You know, and what's my question? What did you do? You know, what happened? There's always an answer. So what do we want to do? We want to embrace the suffering of getting rid of ourselves, of getting rid of the comfort of this life. Embrace the suffering of fasting, of praying, of coming to church even when you don't want to come to church, of being hammered in a homily or being yelled at by your priest in confession. I don't do that, don't worry. But if I really see it necessary, I will, just like that priest did for me. He didn't do it to me. He did it for me. Embrace that suffering, and you'll start to learn humility. Embrace humility, and you'll start to love. Those three things go together, and those are central to everything that Christ teaches. Okay, I had a couple of notes about things I wanted to talk about, but we really don't have time. Are there any quick questions that we have about these topics? Yes. quick questions. the question is, what if your family goes to hell? Well, guess what? We have an eternal hope here. I mean, we have a very, very strong hope. Are there cases in the lives of the saints of people who were not Christians and even people who rejected Christ who were plucked out of hell and placed into paradise? Yes. Yes, that actually has happened. Now, I don't want to get too far into that. That's going to confuse a lot of people and scandalize a lot of people. That's a whole other talk. But the reality is that our hope resides with Christ. And if you can have mercy on your family, do you think you're going to have more mercy than Christ had? No. No. Now, of course, this comes... Eventually, they have to make a choice. But Christ knows the reasons for that choice. He knows what the motivations of their hearts are. And so what do? We pray. We pray. We never let that hope extinguish. If through suffering you obtain humility and through humility you obtain love, that love causes you to know God so well that you don't despair. And you don't even despair of others. So, we have that hope, we pray. It's a powerful thing. I will tell you, as a priest, it doesn't happen all the time, but I've had people who have passed away who, when I prayed for them, at first, when I prayed for them, all there was angst. You just sense it. There's a heaviness. I could tell this person is suffering. But you do the proskimidi, preparation of communion. You pray for them, you give alms for them, you fast, you do everything you can, and little by little that feeling starts to go away. And you start to sense peace when you pray for them. It's happened. It's definitely happened. So, just as we ask the saints to intercede for us, we ask them to intercede for our loved ones, and we also pray. Okay, maybe that's a good place to end it. Okay.